At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The state is calling it political targeting. They're seeking the death penalty. But behind the headlines is a legal machine, one that is complex, high stakes, and slow by design. Tyler James Robinson stands accused of murdering Charlie Kirk in a calculated public attack. A note, a text, a long gun from a rooftop. But what comes next? How does a defense team fight a case like this? What happens when the death penalty is on the table? And what does the public need to understand about how the system actually works? It's a lot that's going to be happening in the coming weeks, months, years in this case. And it's important to understand what's going on before one decides to, jump on their social media and start spouting off about these horrible defense attorneys. How could someone defend him? It's their job and they don't have a choice. And we're going to talk about that. Joining me, Eric Faddis, a criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor, to break down what's ahead and suppression from suppression battles to jury strategy to mitigation, appeals, and what justice is never, why it's never as simple as guilt or innocence. Eric, thanks for joining us. Let's just start with the fact it's a capital case. From your experience, how does a capital case immediately shift the way the defense has to approach the strategy, motion practice, and funding? Walk us through the legal terrain that gets activated the moment the state says, we're going to try and kill you.
Sure, Tony. Well, obviously, it becomes truly a life or death matter for the defense side. And a life was taken on the other side, too. So extremely high stakes here. Usually, most states, especially if there is public funding for the representation, have set aside additional reserves for funding for cases like this, for experts, for mitigation, for investigation, really everything under the sun, because that's what the defense team has to explore. This is their client's life on the line. And so no holds barred, and they pull out all the stops, and I anticipate they're going to do that here.
I mean, it's going to go with a very obvious question so we can get it out of the way, because everybody is going, well, he's on camera doing it.
Right.
He's admitted to doing it. He's got a note. His DNA's on the trigger. It's one of those, common sense would say, well, come on. But of course, you have to try it. Either he has to admit guilt or it has to be tried in court. And then you have to have attorneys that represent him. Give us the explanation for the people that are out there going, who would represent him? Why do we even have to go through all this stuff?
Sure. And fair question. And there are a number of answers. One is that, in our society, we don't just sort of roll over and take whatever the government says as gospel, right? They have to prove their case. And that's only a meaningful requirement if there are challenges to the case, if that case is scrutinized by the defense side. Because we need to establish the authenticity of these alleged text messages between Tyler Robinson and his partner. We need to establish the identity of him on this surveillance video that is pretty grainy and not horribly conclusive. On top of that, if there's been a confession, we need to determine, hey, was that a false confession? Was he pressured in some way? All of these avenues need to be explored, especially when his life is now on the line.
How are they going to do all of that? And do you anticipate them challenging any of these things? Because I agree, and we already got a comment, did you see the fake text messages? People are throwing their conjecture in there, and it's their opinion. Great. Do I think it's a lot of it's weird? Yes, I do. I think there's a lot of weirdness to this whole damn thing. So let me just say that out there right now. But, that's why we have court cases. That's why this is going through a trial, or maybe it will be. So to break all this stuff down, let's take, for example, the text messages. Do you think they're going to challenge this? And then if they do, what's the process? We've seen these sort of things challenged in other cases that are not of this high of profile, but where could all of that go?
Sure. So in looking at the text messages, like I said, the government has to establish that they are authentic, that they're not created by some AI, that they're not created by some investigator, that they need to establish the phone from which these or device from which these messages were sent. And they need to establish who the sender is. So, you know, when you look at the text, you say, oh, that seems pretty problematic for the defense. But there are, when you really break it down, a lot of requirements the prosecution has to meet. On top of that, I think defense would be remiss if they did not hold the government to their burden to establish, hey, these texts are authentic. They're from Tyler Robinson. Here's how we know that. There'll be digital forensics analysis to try and establish IP addresses, locational information in terms of where the device was used, when it was used, and by whom. And that all is going to play out in the coming weeks and months.
Okay, so let's play the conspiracy road here. If they're fake, which is a huge, huge if, and I'm not saying they are by any means, but let's say, how would they prove if they're manufactured? They came from the government showing us, hey, here's what we found. I mean, I'm assuming they're not going to go forward with things that are obviously easy to find as being faked, if they're faked. So that in itself presents an insane challenge of proving something is fake if it's already coming from them saying this is real. I mean, yes, I know you can forensically look at it, but this is a little different than, you know, Joe Blow and a domestic dispute or something. There's going to be a lot of, and people will challenge this, and of course the conspiracy theorists will go nuts with it. How do you suffice that to, let's say they are legit, how do you prove to anyone that they are, and truly make someone believe that they are, if they are? I mean, it seems like it's going to be a mounting battle both ways.
Oh, sure. Like you said, there's going to be a digital forensic analysis that looks at IP addresses, locational information, that kind of thing. But on top of that, what defense is probably going to do, they're going to take these text messages and they're going to look at other writings, other messages, other texts, emails from this defendant. And they're going to compare them and they're going to say, hey, is the tone the same? Is the verbiage the same? Is the sentence structure the same? Is the syntax and grammar the same? And if there is some stark contrast between Tyler Robinson's other messages and these messages, that at least raises a specter that, hey, where did these come from? Were these really from Tyler Robinson, or were they from some other source? So there's a lot of comparative analysis that is going to be done. And they're also going to look at, hey, you know, if the digital analytics say that this message was sent on this date from this location, but Tyler Robinson was somewhere else, well, we got a problem then. And so all of these considerations come into play.
It really has changed the landscape, hasn't it? As far as defending somebody. Now we have to look at AI. We have to look at, I mean, Sora, Tony did some amazing things over the weekend with Sora, which, if you don't know what that is, it's basically AI making videos, and they're so realistic. So how do you take a look at things and go, wow, the entire nation thinks it's one thing because of a video that was released and went viral, not saying it happened, but it could, versus what reality is? It's shocking.
It's a critical point, Stacey, and I think that the emergence of AI is going to have a drastic impact in the legal sphere, in the political sphere, and in other contexts. Yes. I mean, look, over the weekend, I saw this video that purported to show Stephen Hawking in his wheelchair on a skate vert ramp doing tricks.
It's real. He did that shit.
You know, it was darn convincing for what it was. And so, we've got to look at whether things have been not only fabricated, but whether they've been augmented, whether they've been changed in some way to sort of tip the scales of justice one way or the other. And it's not only the government we got to look at. We got to look at defense potentially doing that as well.
Well, and that's a scary thing, because people are going to believe what they want to believe. And if they see something that reaffirms their already held beliefs of whatever it may be, whether you think he did it or he didn't do it, or it's a conspiracy. And people will see things, and we don't know how this is going to work out yet. We don't know. And what I was saying, how it's going to work out yet, is how AI at this level is going to work out in our society yet. There was recently a movie on, I think it was on, what was it, Apple? Or it was Steve Carell was in it. It's about a bunch of tech bros. And the AI, they created this thing. Basically, it's Sora, where you can create almost any situation and it looks like a real news report and people are believing things that are not actually happening around them, things that challenge their political beliefs, things that get them upset, make them believe someone is going after something they feel passionate about, and the world erupts into chaos. We're pretty much there. We are right there right now, where this could become reality, where people are going to start doing that. And the same with this. People have a hard time digesting, accepting, and believing actual videos, things you can prove.
Yes.
And trace the, here's the security camera, here's where this was shot, here's showing him here, here's all this, here's all these people who saw it, here's where he's on the, like, you could give a lineup of every which way that you could physically truly prove things are real, and you will still have people saying that's fake news. So what the hell are we facing when even the real stuff isn't believed? And they haven't believed it forever without this new noise coming in from the other side.
Yeah. So I think from a legal perspective, this is where the burden of proof comes in. You don't, as the government, have to prove something 100% that it's absolutely true. You have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And so what I would do in jury selection as a prosecutor sometimes, I would say, hey, if I told you my name was Eric Vadas and I showed you my driver's license,
fake news,
I had my mother come in here and say that I birthed this person, you know, Is it theoretically possible that I'm some body double, that I'm some faker who's assuming this guy's personality? I guess it's possible, but is it reasonable? And so that's where the government has to prove, hey, so long as we've proven it beyond a reasonable doubt, not all doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt, the jury should accept it. So I think the burden does have an impact on that issue.
When you saw that Stephen Hawking video this weekend, and you know you started just kind of run it through your filters of like, okay, well, yeah, that's Stephen Hawking on a, you know, doing stuff on a skateboard park, obviously AI, but yeah, I saw him too. I even made a few versions of it. You do have to wonder, okay, how is this going to affect like jury selection, things like that in the future? People, I mean, obviously it's already hard to find jurors that are qualified in a specific jurisdiction on any sort of high profile case based just on the social media noise and all the stuff that people consume online. We had memes, we have, you know, people's opinions, blah, 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 blah. Keeping the topic on AI, how do you think this is going to be detrimental to going forward and finding qualified jurors, or is this just another piece of noise that society is going to find a way to filter out in some sort of way to tell real from fake? At least some people will. I don't know. I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that.
Oh, sure. I mean, we're as a society, we're going to have to adapt. And there's going to be some speed bumps along the way. And, you know, look, if I'm the prosecution in a case where that's a potential issue, I'm not wanting the conspiracy folks. I'm not wanting the people who sort of think outside the box.
No,
I want the more, mainline, standard type of thinker who can accept my position. If I'm defense, you bet I want folks who are going to question things, who are going to look deeper, who are going to think more critically into those matters, because they might find some doubt that the former group may not find.
Yeah. And there's like you were talking earlier, one of the things that a lot of people are questioning is not, I mean, the texts, then yes, the note, but I'd say the texts are really what people are wondering about. And look, I get it. It looks weird. The verbiage is not what one would think of a typical, 20-year-old today using. I mean, it just doesn't sound at all. I mean, if you were to just look at it on the surface and go, okay, is this a writing? What would you guess is the writer of this? You wouldn't think a 20-year-old. But, he was well-educated. He had good grades. He may just speak, not in dumbassanese, and the way most people do speak. And, sometimes more educated ways of thinking, that doesn't sound right to me. That may just be what it is. You know, that could easily be. But if we do compare it to other writings, which we do not have, but
which we need,
it's going to be challenged or challenging, I think, for anyone to digest that and believe it, even if they have other writings of him. And it's going to be even more crazy if there are other writings that come to light from, which I'm sure probably will, from school, from friends, from whatever. We're going to see other examples. And if it doesn't match up and it doesn't sound like him, there's going to be problems.
Oh, 100%. And that's really a problem. Largely, the government is going to have to deal with.
Yeah.
Look, they're the ones bringing the charges. They're saying this is our evidence. Okay, we'll show it's authentic. Show that it's real. Prove that the defendant sent that. You know, even in the Young Thug case recently, there were some jail calls that were leaked. And at some point, Young Thug was saying, hey, those might have been AI. That doesn't sound like my voice. That doesn't sound like something I would say. So even when we have the vocal tone, the inflection from the alleged declarant, it's still not a firm, conclusive, final position that we can reach. And so when we have a writing, it could be even more convoluted.
The AI stuff, obviously, it's all very, very new. I'm curious if you or any of your colleagues or anyone you know, and you just mentioned the Young Thug thing, but have you seen any other examples of that being challenged in court saying that must be AI when the evidence just simply, you know, is not favorable to the defendant?
What I've seen, and this, you know, this is an emerging technology,
yeah.
So there are limited examples. But one thing I have seen was that In Colorado, where I practice, there was a case where someone, a romantic partner, framed their other romantic partner by fabricating, I think they were texts, I don't remember exactly, but using some sort of AI generator. And defense was able to establish, hey, my client didn't send these, he couldn't have sent these. And so that alleged piece of evidence was debunked. So I've seen it go that way. Certainly, it could go the other way as well. I just haven't personally seen such an example.
What do you do about this, though? I mean, the other part of this case is he confessed to his family, allegedly. There was the family friend who, a priest or something as well, that helped bring him in. So you get a lot of moving parts over here. It wasn't a standoff where he's by himself, where he just walks in and turns himself in. You have a lot of other individuals that would be close to him in a family capacity, in a family unit, that have all been, you know, accused of being part of this, not in terms of shooting him, Charlie Kirk, but in terms of being part of bringing this man to authorities. So there's that, you know, in, you know, clearer days, would be pretty damn clear cut. Like, your family turns you in. That to me seems pretty strong. Or is it not? I guess it would depend if they were to back out of some of this. We still have yet to hear any sort of statement out of the family in any way, shape, or form, as far as I'm aware, in any of this.
So important points on these alleged confessions. One, the alleged statements from Tyler Robinson to the clergy, those might be suppressed. Typically, there's a privilege in most states whereby you can disclose something to a priest and they might take action on it, but they can't be called as a witness against you. I think that privilege could apply in this case. And then on top of that, when we talk about the alleged confession to the family, what did he actually say? What were his specific words? And, you know, you have on paper, he confessed to his family. That seems really strong. But then you get those family members on the stand and mom says one thing. Dad says another thing. You know, a sibling might say, hey, it was actually more equivocal. It was more vague. And on top of that, you have a potential motivation by a young person to want to gain attention to perhaps to piss off his family. I mean, who knows?
Right.
There are all sorts of possible motivations. And so you have what seems like a pretty sacrosanct confession, but then that thing can kind of unravel as we get into the gauntlet of trial.
Is there any chance that he didn't do this?
I mean, in my personal opinion, I think there's still a chance that he didn't do this. You know, Candace Owen, who is a prominent political figure, I guess you could call her, she has been rather steadfast in asserting that she doesn't think Tyler Robinson did this. There are some curious developments after this. You know, a lot of people are saying that Erica Kirk, Charlie Kirk's widow, her presentation was different than what they would have expected from someone who was killed. I'm not making any comment on that personally, but I'm saying questions have been raised about whether this is actually Tyler Robinson or if there is something larger and more nefarious going on. I don't take a position one way or the other, but mm-hmm. there are questions that at least should be asked.
Sure.
Is a lot of it just the public can't believe their eyes? They can't believe how simple this might have actually been. That you had someone who, through years of being not content, not happy, feeling put off, feeling offended, whatever, you know, he obviously didn't like Charlie Kirk. So insert whatever feelings he's having right there, that had access to a weapon, had access to a key card to a building, which I want to learn about that. How did he have mm-hmm. access to this building? You know, and that may be completely legit. You know, I don't know. You know, and he used the powers he had. It was a very lax security. I mean, they're like, why didn't security? Because there wasn't any security. They didn't think ahead enough to try and prevent something like this. They didn't. They just did not. It was shitty security all around. And it wasn't the role of the campus to provide more than they already had. They only had so many officers they could provide. He had his own private security. He's not the president. So you don't have Secret Service protection around Charlie Kirk. So it was a crime of opportunity. And in theory, the opening was there that somebody did. He did exactly what he said. He saw the opportunity and he acted on it. And then people are reacting to that because it's too simple. I think in some mind, we think of things like this and we think, oh, people plan this forever. We think of like Oklahoma City. We think of the Unabomber. Mm-hmm. We think of 9/11. We think, oh, they're doing this and they're doing that because it must be much more nefarious. Not just some kid that has little problem solving skills and is offended and has access to high power weaponry and a key card. That could be as simple as it is. And then the Erica Kirk too. Could it just be as simple as it is? This is how she reacts. This is how she reacts to trauma and tragedy. It's not how I would react. It's not how you would react. It's not how your sister would react. It's not how your cat's cousin would react. It's how she reacts. Like it or not, it's how she reacts. But everyone wants to judge what's appropriate or not, or what they think is appropriate, not by their standards. And then if it's not according to theirs, then it must be something's up and something's wrong. People not really accepting reality on reality's terms, or is it, you know, are we pointing out this just doesn't feel like reality? Because it doesn't.
It's a very important point. You know, looking at Erica Kirk's response, she was thrust into the public limelight in the most tragic of ways, having just lost her husband. And then, you know, who knows how a person would react to those circumstances. She is now at the helm of this Turning Point organization, which is a very large national entity. And she's trying her best potentially to make sense of it all and to navigate the next steps. And that could very well be what's going on. I think a lot of folks are a little guarded when it comes to, like you said, the emergence of AI, this sort of, you know, alternative facts and, you know, fake news and stuff like that. I think these things that have arisen in our society have caused folks to be more guarded about not just readily accepting something that is put on a plate and a nice little package in front of them. And so perhaps that is what's fueling some of the skepticism regarding the case, and it could be as simple as the government is portraying it.
I think that's the scary part to a lot of us, is like, wow, it could just be that simple, that these sort of things can happen. People, it shatters comfort levels. Mm-hmm. It shatters, you know, barriers that we have of what we believe of our own security when we find out, oh my God, it was that easy for this to happen? Yeah, it was that easy for this to happen. And that's a scary thing. I want to talk about the charges on this, the charging document, political targeting enhancements. That's not commonly used, but it is sometimes. How does political targeting enhancement, how does that work legally? And what kind of evidentiary burden does the state have to meet to justify that? And how does it help their case?
Yeah, so I think the state's going to use it as an aggravating factor in the death penalty phase. How it works in a death penalty case is there's first a guilt phase. So really, there's two trials. The first trial is the defendant guilty? The second trial is is death an appropriate sentence? And in that second penalty phase, the prosecution presents aggravating factors. This will be one of them, that this was a politically motivated assassination, and that makes it more serious in the eyes of some. And so the government will have a burden of establishing at the penalty phase, if they get that far, that the aggravating factors beyond a reasonable doubt outweigh some of the mitigating factors. And there are mitigating factors that the defense is going to put forth.
Do you think this is ever going to actually reach a trial, like in a courtroom, or is this going to be as many cases? Because the evidence that does exist, if we are to believe it, if we're to accept the government's case and say, okay, you got the DNA, you got this, you got that. I mean, it's a pretty clear cut, like you're not going to win fighting this unless you try to nullify a jury, which I don't think that's going to work at all in this case. If this is the way it is, do you think we're just going to end up with a plea deal to take death off the table? Let me ask you that first before I go to a follow up.
You know, Tony, I think it's a plea deal is less likely in this case than it may have been if this case happened 10 years ago. One reason, for better or for worse, I think there is some political aspect to everything going on. You know, the Utah governor, who's Republican, has said that he wants the death penalty. President Trump, who's Republican, has said he wants the death penalty. Charlie Kirk was clearly Republican, the victim and mm-hmm. alleged victim in the case. And so, you know, there's more pressure on that side to drive this all the way home if they can. And in order to do that, they would have to not extend a plea offer. And so I think a plea offer is less likely in this mm-hmm. case, but prosecution has some exposure. There's no guarantee they win at the death penalty phase.
And it would also then that in the interest of it's not to stifle people that have conspiracy theories, but in the interest of bringing truth to light, if there's truth to be brought to that light, a trial would be the most advantageous way to do it, because all of these things would then have to be parsed out. Everything we just talked about. If there's a plea deal, all this stuff goes under the table. It's done. There's really nothing. We're not going to know. It's just going to be like, well, it's what they said. So I guess that's what it is. That's why he's going to jail for prison for the rest of his life. If there is a plea deal, if we do end up in court, all these things will go under a microscope. All these things will be examined by people more than just the federal government. If in fact they are going to try and fight and say he's innocent, but we don't know where that's going to go yet, obviously.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, that's the central purpose of a jury trial, is to find truth. Now, does it always find it? Absolutely not. But in theory, that's the objective. And what happens, like you said, is that evidence would be scrutinized. It would be challenged. There would be alternative, plausible explanations presented by defense, and the jury would have to weigh, hey, is this what the prosecution says it is? Or is there reasonable doubt as to this alternative explanation for whatever is being presented? That's when it comes down to it in that jury trial. It'd
be very fascinating to see how that works. Let me ask you this. The attorney that has been appointed thus far to this, obviously they have to be death penalty qualified. And they've been appointed, again, I want to make that clear. It wasn't like somebody said, hey, pick me. It's what the hell do you think's going through that poor person's mind right now as they're realizing, oh, my God, now I mean, because like nobody's going to, plenty of people will understand this is a person doing their job. This is but the other 80-90% of Neanderthals will be like, screw them. It's like, okay. I don't envy that person at all. What do you think they're dealing with?
They certainly have an uphill battle ahead of them. But you know, in thinking about other cases, you look at the Aurora Theater shooting case, James Holmes in my home state of Colorado. And, you know, that guy killed more than 10 people. And it was the evidence was pretty compelling that it was him who did it. And the government still did not convince a jury to sentence him to death. In fact, it was George Brockler who was at the helm of that trial for the government. I just beat him in a homicide trial. he didn't do a great job in that case. But with the Worth shooting case, even though it seems very clear cut, that doesn't mean that there is a foregone legal conclusion of death. The defense still has some legal traction, not only to challenge the guilt of their client, but also to try to spare their client's life at that penalty phase. So even though it appears very overwhelming, there is still a lot of work that can be done on the defense side.
Lots of questions, lots of possibilities for where this Choose Your Own Adventure book may end up going. And it's scary to think about. Eric Faddis, thank you for your insight on this. Let us know your thoughts in the comments section, wherever you are listening to us. Be sure to press subscribe and let us know your thoughts on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Moving on now, the prosecution's case against Corey Richens just took another serious hit. Eric's here to talk with us about all of that. And their key witness, Robert Crozier, has now recanted, saying that he never sold fentanyl to the housekeeper at the center of the state's supply chain theory. That single reversal undercuts a narrative that prosecutors have relied on for over a year. But with a toxicology report showing five times a lethal dose of fentanyl, no physical fentanyl recovered, and 26 additional financial crimes on the table, where does this case actually stand? We're going to dig into this now. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, is with us to continue to dig into this one. It's been a while since we talked about it. How big of a blow is this to the prosecution, or is it not, to the murder charges that they're trying to bring against Corey Richens?
You know, it's clearly significant, and I've said this, said it earlier today, but a case might look really good on paper, but then once you get closer to trial, some things can go south. Some things can turn on you that you don't expect. Here, we have a witness recanting, which damages the government's case. That witness was the alleged initial source of the toxin that Corey Richens used to kill her husband. So that's a problem. It messes up the sequence of events, sort of that a sequential chain. But that being said, there's a lot of other significant evidence that even if this dude is being shifty about what he did, that doesn't take away from the fact of what was found in the alleged victim's body and the other pieces of evidence you mentioned. So I think the case is still reasonably strong, but this is a blow.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tony.
No, I just said, it certainly does deal one. Go ahead.
I'm curious. It's been a while since we've talked about this case. What does the authorship of her book have to do with any sort of defense? Does that come into play that, look, she's feeling so much trauma over losing her husband that she wrote this book with her children? This couldn't be a woman who allegedly killed her husband. How does that book play into this? And I know we've probably have covered this at some point a long time ago, but it's been a while.
Stacey, I think both sides are going to have their own interpretations of the book and what it means for the case. On the prosecution side, hey, what's a really smart way if you killed your husband but really don't want to be blamed for it and want to actually come out, smelling like roses from that? You write this kind of book where you're trying to sort of pacify a child based on their father's death and make things all better. If you're the defense, you say, hey, this was a sincere expression from a widow who just lost her husband, who is now being blamed, who has subsequently been blamed for that. But this was her thoughts in terms of how to show compassion for her child and help the child adjust and help other kids adjust. That's a good thing. So there are multiple interpretations. It'll depend on which one the jury accepts.
When someone recants their testimony like this, he gave a reason. He said, I was in recovery. I was, fresh into it at that moment in time. And yes, I said that, but it wasn't accurate at that moment in time. Okay. I mean, a lot of people based a lot of decisions on your testimony at that moment in time. Why did you change it now? Why did you not know it at that moment in time? I mean, this is a story. This is a case where there's already a lot of accusations of Corey trying to steer this case from behind bars with the wag the dog letter, things of that nature, trying to get people to say things certain ways. At least if we're to read the tea leaves that way, and it is what the state is saying it was about, and not just some sort of plot for a book that she was writing, which would be the worst book in the world. So I guess, how do we know what the motive truly is behind recanting that testimony? And do they dig into that at all? Can they dig into that at all? Or is it just, well, that's what this person says. It holds no more weight than, I guess, him saying, you know, he did deal the fentanyl versus not dealing the fentanyl. Again, it's just his words one way or the other.
Those motivations will certainly be inquired into during the jury trial phase by defense. And look, you know, human beings are often terribly inconsistent. We like to think that, you know, we have this case file and it says, you know, this person said this and that helps our case and he's going to say that at trial and things are going to be great. But human beings are all over the place in terms of their statements, in terms of positions, shifting opinions, different motivations, and all those things come into play. The question will be, do those variances give rise to some sort of doubt that is an approximation of reasonable doubt? I don't think alone that recantation does that, but if defense can use that in addition to other inconsistencies, prosecutors might have a problem.
The absence of any recovered fentanyl pills tied to Corey has been repeatedly reported in this. But we have to remember the context of the case, too. Corey was a free woman for quite some time after this. Mm-hmm. She had a book. She was doing TV appearances on the local, you know, Good Morning, you know, wherever, you know, shows. And so no fentanyl recovered later. There's plenty of time to get rid of fentanyl if you had any in the house.
Right.
You know, there wasn't like we're busting down the doors right after he died. What do you have here? How strong of an argument is it by the defense of, well, you didn't find any fentanyl in the house? Like, yeah, I mean, you probably didn't find any, you know, murder weapons and bloody gloves and shit in somebody's house either if they committed a crime like that and you arrest them several months later.
Oh, right. You know, I think it's not terribly significant for the defense, something they'll put forward. But gosh, when a person commits a crime, it's reasonable to think that they might try to cover their tracks, that they might try to dispose of evidence that could link them to that crime. And especially when you have this interval of time that Corey Richards had, she had many opportunities to do that. And so I think the prosecution will be able to sort of neutralize that fact by saying, yeah, but, you know, if a person did this, it's reasonable to think they would have made sure there was no evidence, you know, sitting in their dresser drawer of what is essentially the murder weapon in this case.
What about the earlier accusations? And again, it's there is no toxicology to show that any of it is true. There was the accusations that on Valentine's Day she tried to poison one of his sandwiches, and that was relayed through, you know, basically him telling a family member or friend, I forgot which it was, that, you know, I think she might be trying to kill me. If anything ever happens to me, you know, look at her. I'm just kind of paraphrasing what was allegedly communicated there.
Isn't that the biggest witness of all?
Well, is it? Look, you can look at it another way, too. I want to answer that question first, because I'm going to play devil's advocate here in a second. Go ahead.
Yeah. So as a general rule, if someone is going to present a statement of the defendant at trial that's incriminating, they've got to do that at trial. Well, the statement, the declarant of the statement is deceased. He's not going to testify at trial. And so there arises potentially a confrontation clause issue under the Sixth Amendment, whereby the defense can't cross-examine on this alleged statement. You know, what did he exactly say? What were his exact words? To whom did he say it? Under what circumstances? All of these aspects. And so there's a chance that the judge doesn't let it in. But if the judge does let it in, it shows a potential pattern of poisoning, which is extremely damning to the defense. We saw that in the James Craig Dennis case. Mm-hmm. In Colorado. There was a similar pattern, and he's behind bars for life.
It's a pattern, according to him. And again, he's dead. He can't talk about it. I'm playing devil's advocate here. Or it could be showing a pattern of paranoia. It could be showing a pattern of someone who thinks that their wife is out to kill them and they're not, and is talking to their friends and family about it. And it could be showing, you know, if you're in that situation, if you're Corey and you have a spouse that's not basing, you know, there's cognitive distortions going on that are telling them that your wife is doing this, that would be a hellish type scenario to be living under. If you were, Corey, and your husband is kind of feeling these ways or thinking those sort of ways, and you know, and then you add, well, why are they thinking these sort of ways? Well, is there an underlying drug problem going on as well?
Yeah, you know, it's a fair question.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this, I mean, there could be other explanations other than just that. There is mental illness, there's disorder. I have no idea. I have no idea what was going on with him. I don't know, you know, it doesn't mean it was always diagnosed or always checked out or recognized. Again, it would be her argument against everybody else's. I'm not trying to give her, you know, here's, try this one, Corey. But I don't know. It's not a crazy thing to think about.
Oh, sure. You know, there are fabrications all the time. There are inaccurate accusations. Sometimes they are innocent. Sometimes they are malicious. And so all of those things could potentially explain such a statement. And that's why it's so difficult to have such a statement admitted at trial, because the decedent isn't there to be questioned, to ask about, hey, you know, were you struggling with drugs yourself at the time? Were you struggling with mental illness at the time? Those sort of things. I'm not saying he was, and I'm not saying that that somehow absolves Corey Richmond of the accusations, but I'm just saying that these are important questions when it comes to the value and weight of such a statement from a person who's no longer with us.
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is another one of those cases too, where people are looking and going, well, I certainly wouldn't do that, like having a party at the house that you're husband said, no, you shouldn't be buying. This is a bad investment for us. And the second he's dead, you're like popping bottles.
It was pretty much the second after. Yeah, it was what, a couple days, maybe in the next day or 2 days.
It's a little odd, a little strange, but so does, you know, fireworks at your husband's funeral, you know. But again, it doesn't necessarily mean that we know what the hell's going on in that person's mind. They could just be dealing with things extremely differently than we are, for whatever reason that may be. It's just how they deal with it. There's personality disorder, there's mental illness, there's whatever it may be. Who the hell knows? It's who they are, and that person is not you. So I you know, it's another one of those, well, that's how they are, but does it mean anything?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've seen folks who have gone through tragedy, and some of them try their best to maintain a sense of normalcy, to maintain sort of a normal presentation to their friends, to their family. They try to keep living their lives. Sometimes they're in denial. Sometimes it's a coping strategy to try to get past this horrible thing in their life. And all of that can be completely innocent. Now, on the other hand, it can be very incriminating when, you know, it appears that a person has moved on so quickly that the inference that some could draw is this person wasn't that bummed out by her partner dying. And oh, look, there's these other pieces of evidence that kind of suggest that she might have had a hand in that. When you put those together in a totality, that's when the jury is hopefully going to see the real truth, whatever that truth is.
And look, I'm going to throw this other horrible one in here too for this case. Again, I know nothing about them. I have no idea what their relationship was like. I have no idea what he was like. Let's say this was just a really miserable relationship, and they weren't very happy together. I mean, there is some evidence of that, at least if you're to believe the testimony, the statements that have been given by family members, where, you know, it sounds like he's, you know, paranoid that he might get killed by his wife. If you're in a very unhealthy relationship on both sides, and let's say she didn't do it, let's say this all just looks really, really horrible, but he does die of this overdose, maybe by his own hand and maybe by accident, not intentional, and he's dead. But for a second, let's say you're living with a spouse that you detest, that life is a living hell for whatever reason, whether it's their fault, your fault, a combination of faults, whatever, you're just in a miserable state, and they die. Suddenly, unexpected, and you had nothing to do with it. And maybe you're kind of relieved because that fucking nightmare is over. Wouldn't be the way everybody reacts, but I can certainly think of several people who would or could that are not evil human beings that, you know, if you're going through hell and the relationship is already heading towards a divorce and this ends up being the way out through a horrible accident, not everybody is going to be, oh my God, this is the worst thing in the world, if you were already wanting out of that relationship. And it also doesn't mean you murdered them.
Right.
Totally. And I think that that's why we have to be cautious in terms of how much weight we're placing in these human reactions like this that can run the gamut. There's a whole spectrum of how a human being could react to such an event and its influence, like you said, based on the relationship dynamics, based on the circumstances of the person, based on any number of things. And so we've got to be careful. It's the same thing with Erica Kirk. You know, some people raise some eyebrows and that's okay, but in terms of her reaction. But I think we got to be careful in terms of how much weight we place in it,
yeah,
because it's so unpredictable how a human being might respond, especially under such grave circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, completely. I want to talk about one, the reason that the recantation is getting so much attention right now from the individual who says, you know, I didn't ever sell fentanyl, I was selling oxy, was because the accusation is that this recantation took place in April, and we're in October, and the defense is saying, we just found out about this now, and they're saying, you know, piece of evidence, exculpatory piece of evidence here, we're just finding out about this now. They're arguing it could be a Brady violation. Is it, or is it the defense, you know, we're going to say it's a Brady violation. It sure kind of looks like it could be. That's a big deal to not turn over a piece like this. Is it not, or are they doing their job and, you know, they're playing this to the media, but making it bigger than it actually is?
Well, I think constitutionally, it's a significant problem. Yeah. As you alluded to, there are cases, including the Brady case and its progeny, which essentially state if there is evidence that tends to negate the guilt of the defendant and the government has this in their possession, not only do they have to turn it over, but they have to take reasonable measures to turn it over promptly. It's not something you can kind of hold close to the vest until the 11th hour and then say, oh, surprise. So I think that that's a problem. They should have turned it over before. I can't think of a good explanation why they didn't. And if I was defense, I'd be raising hell about it. Absolutely. Now, is it a complete game changer? Does it prove she's not guilty? No, it doesn't prove that. But it is a material withholding of exculpatory information. And we're talking about a level playing field. We're talking about a murder case. That's a big violation on behalf of the prosecution. In terms of what the remedy is going to be, that's what the judge will have to decide.
Another thing that's being emphasized so much is the financial motive in this case, that there was a lot of debt, and usually the equation goes debt plus motive equals guilt. And that obviously is not always the case. And I question that a little bit, especially when we're talking about debt. It's not like there was, you know, a lot to necessarily gain here other than control and her ability to get that house, you know, and when her husband said, no, honey, we're not going to put our money towards that. You have that there, but when we're talking about debt, wouldn't you be better served to have the spouse still alive and then get divorced and then split that debt rather than have it all pile on your ass when your husband's now dead? Because that's simply what takes place in this scenario.
Unless the life insurance policy was such that it would clear out that debt.
I think that's being questioned, though, too, and I don't know what was there in terms of policies.
Yeah, you know, all important considerations. But yeah, I think you raise a good point that there'd be better ways to address the debt than just offing your husband. However, if there were other motivations involved in addition to that, and there was a way to secure life insurance policy and to benefit one's own monetary position through the death of their spouse, then that could be seen in that incriminating light. But yes, I think debt is used oftentimes in these cases, and there's not always the best logical connection to, oh, they were in debt, that means he killed her. Well, why does there's a bit of a non sequitur there, and the prosecution is going to have to sort of fill in that gap.
Yeah, it's kind of got to play it out, like, what really is Evan? And it doesn't mean like they didn't kill them thinking this was a great idea and not really playing it out in their mind going, wait a second, that's not a great idea. But I mean, who knows? I want to ask you this as an attorney, and we hear these phrases thrown around so much of, oh my gosh, there's terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data to go through. 11 terabytes in this case. And yeah, that does sound like a lot on paper. Is that a lot? I mean, there's large files. You know, video can take up a terabyte if you have a lot of video in like one single file. And we don't know what's all in that. When you see that, being thrown out there of all this, these terabytes of data you have to go through, what are we actually talking about when you as an attorney get that dump of data? How difficult is that to truly go through today? I know years ago, probably a different story without the tools that exist. But today, what does it really mean?
You know, I can give an example from a recent homicide case that I handled on the defense side, and the client has authorized me to disclose this. So there were more than 2 terabytes of data from a digital download from multiple devices, like I think 4 devices or so, and that contained 120,000 emails, about 100 and some thousand text messages. And granted, you know, I didn't have to go through all of those. I didn't have to go through the emails that were 10 years old because they had such a attenuated relationship with the alleged event. So you kind of have to be strategic in how you go about it. You can hire digital forensic analysts. There are tools, like you said, including AI's tools that can summarize evidence. Mm-hmm. But you got to be careful about that because you don't want to miss something and you don't want to draw a wrong conclusion based on the AI hallucination or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was that case that there were more than 2 terabytes. Terabytes is a substantial amount, but you know, they've had months, they have a defense team. These are just things that they have to get through, and so they're going to have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I know I don't use the tools, obviously. I'm not an attorney. I have touched them a few times, you know, when working on some cases. But I've been kind of blown away by some of it, like, oh my God, you could really parse out a lot of information really quick. I mean, just give us some insight into some of the tools that can be used in terms of AI finding data. When you need to find something about a phone call in a case, you no longer have to have, you know, 50 legal assistants combing through everything. You can type it in and boom, boom, boom. Here's what we found. I mean, it can be that easy today, can it not?
Oh, it can. And in addition to criminal defense, I also do some personal injury work. Mm-hmm. And so in those cases, we have thousands upon thousands of pages of medical records,
yeah,
including prior records, all sorts of stuff. And there are AI systems that can digest that very quickly and give. And you could say, hey, can you list the most significant medical procedures or even medical events in this case when we have treatment that has spanned years and years, and it can give it to you in a few minutes. And so there are ways to really be efficient and shorten the time it takes to review all of those things and distill the most salient points.
Mm-hmm. We are, like 4 months out from trial on this, supposedly? It's roughly what I think we're talking about here. She is arguing, Corey Richens is saying, you know, because of this, because of the potential Brady violation here, I should be out on bail until then. Is that a strong argument based on what we've learned?
I don't think so, in part because when a judge sees a potential Brady violation like this, the judge has to decide, what's the remedy going to be? Am I going to dismiss the whole case? Am I going to suppress evidence? Am I going to do something else? But usually that remedy has to be tied in some way to the nature of the violation, the nature of the evidence that was withheld. So you can't, I don't think it really logically follows to say, hey, the prosecution withheld this evidence about this recanted testimony. Therefore, let me go be out of custody and live a normal life until the trial. That remedy is not tailored to the nature of the violation. So I think that is a large ask for the judge, and I don't think the judge is likely to grant it.
It's going to be fascinating as this one gets closer. And I'm really hoping for her next book. I like to read that first one all the time. I'm on chapter one because there's only one chapter and I'm on the second page now. I've C-spot run is how it starts. It's a good one. I highly recommend it. Available wherever you get books. Is it still out there? Can you buy it on Amazon?
No, it's not.
Oh, it's gone.
Yeah.
Ah, We should make an AI version of it. Make a new version. Eric Faddis, as always, thanks for coming on and giving us your insight into these cases. Invaluable, as always. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
If you have an opinion on this, you want to get your thoughts out there, please let us know it in the comment section on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You'll find us there, and you can have your voice be heard as well. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're watching or listening as well. Until next time, for Stacey and Todd and Eric, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.